Hello, everybody. This is Liver Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights with Kim and Nancy. We are really excited to have our good friend Tatiana Kushner joining us. I'm going to let Kim and Tatiana introduce themselves, but today's episode is to discuss some of the new developments around hepatitis B. So it's been a long time since we could be excited about curing or controlling another virus. Hepatitis C really put a pretty high bar there, but hopefully Tatiana can convince us that we can start bringing the word cure into the hepatitis B conversation. So I'm going to turn it back over to Kim, my partner, and then we'll let Tatiana introduce herself.
Thanks, Nancy. Well, I think we've met socially in many ways before, but I'm Kim Brown, and I'm one of the transplant hepatologists here at Henry Ford, and very excited to have Tatiana join us today. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi, Kim. Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Tatiana Kushner, and I'm a hepatologist at Weill Cornell in New York, and excited to talk about hepatitis B.
Excellent. Well, we'll dive right in. So, Tatiana, tell us what is new on the hepatitis B front that's got everyone all excited.
Well, one word, Bepi. So, we all just came back from EASL, the European Association for the Study of Liver Disease, meeting about a month ago now. And during that time, that was in May, we heard the phase 3 study results for the bepirovirsen trial for the treatment of chronic hepatitis B. And simultaneously, the results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we're all very, very excited to see this phase 3 data after waiting a little while after we heard the phase 2 data. And the phase 2 has been published also in New England Journal of Medicine. And really, the excitement comes from, actually at EASL in the audience. The first comment came from, I think, Heiner Wiedermeyer, who stood up and said, this is a historic time for hepatology in general, and specifically for hepatitis B. And that's because in this trial, this is the first phase 3 trial that has demonstrated functional cure for hepatitis B. And we anticipate that based on these study results, that in the not too distant future, from what I hear, maybe in the fall, in October, that this medication may actually be approved for use for our patients with chronic hepatitis B. And this will be the first time that we have medication potentially approved that offers functional cure to a subset of patients with chronic hepatitis B.
Just a quick question, maybe not so quick, which is, can we talk a little bit about functional cure and what it means? And do we think we all agree on what functional cure means today? I know how it was defined in the clinical trial, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it is a really good question. I think, it also relates to if this medication does become approved, how we even speak to our patients about it. Like, why is this superior to, say, them staying on their tenofovir and entecavir, which does not offer functional cure? So functional cure is defined as sustained hepatitis B surface antigen loss off treatment. And I do know that, for years there had been a discussion of, well, what truly should be our more durable endpoint? Like, we had terminology such as sterilizing cure, and I think the community in general landed on functional cure because we know that surface antigen loss, sustained surface antigen loss, is associated with significantly improved long-term disease outcomes, decreased risk of HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, decreased risk of progression to cirrhosis, and improved disease outcomes. Still, we have conversations about, well, is this really fully durable in the sense that there's still that CCC DNA that we're not necessarily addressing with functional cure? And do we need other medications that really go to the core, which is addressing the CCC DNA, the integrated DNA? But at the very least, we know that functional cure does offer a long-term disease benefit. I think the community has come on board with accepting this as an important, very important disease endpoint. I think even, you know, with this new data, there also is now a discussion about the idea of partial functional cure. So is there a benefit of even if the surface antigen is not completely reduced to zero, is there a benefit to having surface antigen less than 100, for example, because that's sort of a partial cure? And so I think we can discuss that more in terms of, well, you know, should there be levels or stages of surface antigen suppression? But I think overall in the community, we agree that functional cure offers significant long-term disease benefit. What do you both think?
I guess one of the questions that I've always had is, you know, we think of functional cure, how do we describe it to our patients? Is it the same as sort of a patient who loses surface antigen naturally, right? I mean, we know the long-term benefits of that for the patient and the risk of cancer, et cetera. Is functional cure equivalent to that? Or is it just a bit of a step down, right? I mean, we reduce cancer risk, et cetera, with nukes. Do we reduce it further if we get, quote, functional cure? Is that the same as somebody who loses surface antigen, develops surface antibody naturally? That's kind of the question that I have, and I don't think we're going to have that answer for a long time until we actually have a number of people who get, quote, functional cure, but I don't know what you think about that.
Right. And it is a hard question to answer because that then numbers of people that lose surface antigen naturally or in the setting of nukes is very, very low. And So, you know, it's hard to tell. I would assume that there's something different about them, that their own immune system was able to accomplish this endpoint. But it's hard to know if it's truly the same. And also, obviously, with clinical trials, yes, you do follow people for some time, but what happens, you know, after week 96, you know, will they have seroreversion or will surface antigen levels increase again? I mean, hopefully not, but that's the other aspect that we'll have to see in the real world. Like, is it truly sustained very long term?
Yeah.
I definitely know some of my patients are excited to be off of their long-term antiviral therapy and seem to at least have no worse outcome. That's the hope. And like you said, Tatiana, we do need longer-term data to be sure that that's true. But presumably, if you're not replicating and your surface antigen is negative, that's certainly no worse than taking a drug that keeps you from replicating. I know that they also had anticipated with the new guidance some of these, you know, new endpoints per se, and that our guidelines, the liver cancer screening surveillance recommendations, started to accommodate for people who lost surface antigen, but lost surface antigen after a time when they were already in a surveillance program. And I guess what I mean by that is that losing surface antigen, you know, may not change your liver cancer outcome. And that means it will still be important to screen for liver cancer, even if you do lose surface antigen on some of these agents. What are your thoughts on that, Tatiana? Do you think that that's going to dampen the enthusiasm for this from a patient perspective?
I mean, honestly, I think that patients that actually follow up with us and that are the types of patients that would be up for going on this type of treatment, the HCC screening part is probably not an issue for them. I think that they would be okay for the most part to continue HCC screening. On the other hand, I think a big benefit for having a finite, you know, functional cure is that theoretically, you know, once they're cured, patients don't have to be thinking about this constantly and that they don't have that stigma associated with taking a medication for this constantly. But then you bring back in, well, you still have to do the HCC screening. So that dampens that a bit. But Overall, I think patients will be enthusiastic to not have to be on really lifelong or long-term medications. I think that will be the big benefit for most patients.
Well, I think too, you know, we're trying to move toward blood-based markers for cancer and get away from imaging. And if that's the case, you're going to be monitoring these patients at least biannually, looking for, you know, is their surface antigen still gone? You know, how's their liver doing? So using those blood-based markers, I don't know that that will in the future be as much of a impediment to them, you know, thinking through what they would like to do with therapy.
That's a really good point. Yeah. If it all becomes just a blood test that they do biannually, even with their primary care doctor, potentially long term, then our job will be done and their lives will be easier because they won't need to schedule imaging and go through all that as well.
So, Tatiana, this isn't a one size fits all drug. So why don't you tell us a little bit of what type of patient would be appropriate to consider for Bepi?
Yes. And interestingly, I have already started talking to some of my patients, you know, just to begin to introduce the concept that this may be coming. And a key part of that discussion is doing this additional test, which is surface antigen quantification. And honestly, my practice, I had not been doing this routinely until recently. And the reason that I wasn't sending this surface antigen quantification is that really it wasn't actionable. There, yes, I could offer some maybe prognostic information to the patient, but it wouldn't change my management per se. But now I did start routinely checking the surface antigen level in all of my patients with chronic hepatitis B. I've had no issue with insurance coverage. It's a simple test. Patients like to see it, provides more information about their disease. And the reason is that if and when Bepi is approved, it will likely be approved for people with low surface antigen levels, specifically less than 3,000. And also I'm hearing from some, maybe even those with less than 1,000. I'm not sure if that's fully defined. But the clinical trial, the phase 3 clinical trial, was specifically enrolling patients who have surface antigen greater than 100 and less than 3,000. And that's because in the phase 2 data, we saw that having that lower surface antigen level was significantly associated with a response. And so the phase 3 study was designed to only include patients with that surface antigen level of less than 3,000. And so the next obvious question becomes, well, who of our patients, having not been traditionally checking this blood test, at least in my practice, who would potentially meet this criteria? Because the surface antigen level is not necessarily correlated with viral load. You know, it's hard to actually know without checking. And I think at conferences, there are discussions now of, well, what proportion of patients in your clinical practice or in the US or in Europe are patients that would meet that criteria? And at least in a recent, there was a Coalition for Hepatitis Elimination conference on surface antigen quantification, and led by John Ward. And, you know, he posed this question to speakers from around the world. And it seemed that the consensus was that about 50 to 60% of patients would actually have surface antigen less than 3,000, which is honestly higher than what I have been anecdotally seeing in my practice. But I'm curious from both of you if you have been checking it, and also what your estimate is. And I'm not aware of US-based data, actually. Maybe that something has been published also to say, like, on a population level in the US, very heterogeneous population, obviously, you know, what percentage of patients have that surface antigen titer?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is we just haven't had access to surface antigen for that long, you know, in the U.S. And so we only have a handful of patients that I think have been tested. I don't have enough experience to say, you know, what percentage I think of our population. We will in the next, you know, few months probably understand that a little bit better. But I don't know, Nancy, do you have a better idea for your population?
So we've been trying to check surface antigen for a while. It's a test that can't be run at rush. So if you have to send something to a commercial lab, there's already a little bit of a hiccup because rush would prefer to do all your labs for you. And that's not a negative thing against the university. It's just that's kind of how it works. And I also have found that even if I write the code and spell out very, you know, nicely what I would like, I often will get a qualitative and not a quantitative surface antigen, even if I send it to LabCorp or Quest, which, you know, is a learning curve. It means that it will eventually be figured out once the lab is getting more requests for quantitative and not qualitative surface antigen. But I think that I've had a little bit of a limitation there. I agree with Tatiana, definitely not 50% of my practice. And I think also some of the conversation I have heard is that the majority of our patients with low surface antigen are going to be in what we would have previously described as inactive carrier. I mean, I think a lot of us have used quantitative surface antigen to help reassure us that a person who's got low replication is an inactive carrier and not someone who has E antigen negative viral hepatitis that you're just intermittently seeing when their liver enzymes are lower or normal. And those patients would not have been what had been recruited into the trial. Now, that doesn't mean that you may not decide to use Bepi on them if allowed, but I think many of my low quantitative surface antigen patients are in a different phase of their Hep B.
Right. I actually, you know, in testing, I also have found a few patients with surface antigens less than 100. And so I thought in a way, maybe these would be the easiest to cure. But in a way, also, I don't know that it will be approved because the clinical trials, you have to have at least a surface antigen titer greater than 100. So it will be interesting to see what the package insert and indication will be once it's approved.
Yeah, and those low surface antigens, they're at the highest chance of losing their surface antigen spontaneously anyway. Right. Now, it doesn't mean that you might not prefer to lose surface antigen years before, you know, you would naturally. Thinking that would be a better endpoint. But this is where we need long-term data, right? If your quantitative surface antigen is less than 100, you may not be the same type of person who's got, you know, quantitative surface antigen of a much higher level, which would imply maybe higher risk for bad long-term outcomes.
Right, for sure. Yeah, and I think the other part, so that's, I think, a key part, the surface antigen levels. And the other is, you know, it's very easy to tell patients that, oh, there's a potential cure coming, but then another punchline is it's not in everyone, even with those surface antigen levels. So with the phase 3 study results, it was 19% of patients with surface antigen levels less than 3,000 who achieved the endpoint, and 28% in the people when you specifically look at surface antigen less than 1,000. So overall, it's about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people that did reach the trial endpoint. And so it's not everyone. So if you do embark on this treatment, that has to be kind of an expectation that not everyone will have that response.
Right. So this is an antisense oligonucleotide, an ASO. So right. I think another thing is, why don't you tell us a little bit about how the drug is given and how you might monitor it?
Yes. So that's another big discussion right now in preparation for potential approval. So this is an injection medication, and it is a weekly injection medication that presumably, I assume, the patient will be able to self-administer at home, although that also is to be determined. I don't know if there will be some idea that they should administer this medication in a monitored setting. So I think that's to be determined. And then the other aspect related to it is that obviously in the clinical trial setting, there was close monitoring of patients. And that's because, well, yes, it's a clinical trial, but also there were signals towards laboratory abnormalities that occurred in the setting of this treatment, which included liver test elevation and concern also for impact on renal function. And so the question is, how frequently will we need to be monitoring patients once this is approved in the real world? And some discussions that I have been a part of have suggested that actually this will require pretty intensive monitoring, maybe even labs weekly and urine tests, at least for the first 12 weeks. And so, of course, we don't know for sure how that will look. But if that were the case, that for sure may limit some people's ability to be on this treatment. So people who are working full time, who don't have the ability to come in for blood work as frequently. And so I think that will be also a really important discussion to have up front with patients before they potentially embark on this.
Just a quick question, which is, given the enzyme elevations and the potential for side effects, do you think there's a group of patients that you would perhaps avoid? Patients maybe with cirrhosis or prior decompensation, or, patients who are on nukes where we really don't withdraw the nukes in general because of that risk. What are your thoughts about patients with more advanced disease at baseline?
Yeah, I don't foresee us using this in people with cirrhosis or decompensated cirrhosis at baseline. I'm actually trying to recall if there was anyone in the clinical trial with more advanced liver disease.
No.
Yeah, so I don't, unless they kind of got in there, without realizing that how advanced their liver disease. So yeah, my assumption would be that it would be approved for people with without less cirrhosis, disease, decompensated. Yeah. I don't know if they would say specific limit on fibrosis stage, but yeah, I think the people that we say are on lifelong treatment, if they have cirrhosis, then they would probably, unfortunately, not qualify for this. And arguably, those are the people that may want it the most, but maybe that will evolve over time. I don't know if there are any plans to study this medication in people with more advanced liver disease.
Not that I'm aware of, but I would think at some point that would be of interest, but I agree with you. I don't think those patients were in the clinical trial and would not be the people that I would start first off.
Right. Right. And then people with baseline renal dysfunction, I think, would also be people that we would not want to start this treatment on. And then, I think that those are the main things.
Yeah, our guidelines are still pretty conservative in our cirrhotics, that recommending antiviral therapy, even in those that don't have replication. So I can't see that this is going to be a big game changer for those with more advanced disease. Also, Tatiana and Kim, your opinion, I think some of the early BEPI data suggested that outcomes were a little bit better, not necessarily more people losing surface antigen and having less replication, but more durable response if they combined it with pegylated interferon. I think the BEPI side effect profile is pretty good. I mean, I think there were still some flu-like, side effects. Interferon's side effect profile, not so good. So would you think of combining the two in some of your patients that really wanted to give it the best hurrah?
Oh, I think we had this discussion last time too. This pegylated interferon keeps coming back. I don't know. Me personally, again, as I had mentioned before, I have a limited clinical experience with using pegylated interferon, with the hepatitis C patients, years ago. And I think the benefit of this treatment would be that it's finite and tolerable. I don't, and you know, it will have already such intensive monitoring potentially. So, you know, selling this treatment, having all these potential caveats, and that, you know, it won't cure really the majority of patients, but then also saying that to add pegylated, I think it would be a tough sell, in my opinion. But curious, would either of you give it a try?
Yeah, I think it'd be a real tough sell for patients. I really think it'd be a tough sell for doctors too. That, you're just, this is already going to be a complicated therapy to introduce with weekly injections, with monitoring that I think is going to be very close monitoring. Many of these patients are sitting, a fair distance from us. So the intensity of the monitoring, I hearken back to days of like telaprevir, where you were monitoring labs, very, very closely, and patients were at a distance to you. It was very difficult for physicians and support staff to actually do that. Now you've added pegylated interferon. I think my mind would be blown trying to trying to manage all of that, and I can't imagine what the patient would be going through. So I don't think that would be my first thought to combine the two.
Well, it is interesting that you mentioned that, you know, I keep forgetting about this telaprevir, bosepravir days, but that was very frequent monitoring, and it was done
Absolutely.
in hepatology practice, and that was done with pegylated interferon. So, there is a paradigm for it. I guess the difference is in that setting, you know, there was a higher likelihood of cure, and there was nothing else. Whereas with hepatitis B, you know, we do have the nuke, so we are able to have patients on treatment that virally suppress them long term. So I don't know that the same motivation wouldn't be there on the side of the patients, but maybe some patients, you know, maybe a
But
few.
I think the difference was, at least for Nancy and me, we had ongoing experience with PEG. So we were just adding telaprevir to that, right?
Right.
In this situation, most practitioners now don't have any recent history with PEG, and now this is a new drug. So they're trying to experience a new drug, bepi and pegylated interferon, and how to incorporate that will be a challenge.
But I am curious, even just bepi alone, in speaking with your patients and just your general patient population, do you have a sense of those patients that meet the surface antigen criteria? How many of your patients, or what types of patients, would be really enthusiastic about starting on this treatment, or what percentage of your patient population? Because it's, you know, again, as I mentioned, I started introducing it to a few patients, and once they hear, oh, there's a new treatment and it's potentially finite, potential cure, there is actually a lot of excitement that I'm hearing. But again, that's before they know maybe all the details of what it will entail.
I think it's going to be a big difference if it's an injectable they can do themselves at home versus something that they have to come in for to be monitored. Because I think that enthusiasm is blunted by the reality of life. And that is going to be challenging. Now, there are many, think about when we were using anti-TNFs, originally. There are times when the risk benefit really weighs towards the inconvenience, but that's where our older, oral drugs work very, very well, so that it's hard to push people to something inconvenient when they have this other option. I want to ask a little bit, Tatiana. I think this is exciting, but will this, this is the first of many targets that are being looked at, and for example, telaprevir and bosepravir, first oral DAAs, not best oral DAAs. And so, is this going to burn bridges? Like, if I put my patient on bepi and they either stop it or they don't get, sustained surface antigen loss, will they no longer be able to get one of these other futuristic treatments?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think we don't know. I mean, from experience in other fields, it seems that as long as there's a washout period, so, you know, there probably would have to be some kind of washout period of 6 months, maybe a year, before they enter a clinical trial, say, for another investigational agent or another agent is approved and they can go on it. But hopefully it wouldn't prevent them from benefiting from potential other treatments. I mean, what would potentially prevent them if they have a severe liver disease flare and then they decompensate? I mean, hopefully we won't see any of that. You know, hopefully we won't worsen their liver disease. And again, I agree the safety data is mostly reassuring. And it seems that the liver test elevation, you know, often is sold in the context of beneficial flares. And so, which I think it is true that many of the people who had significant liver test elevation, they are the ones that went on to have the functional cure. But again, we'll have to see in the real world. But I think on a positive note, this is maybe the first of many other future treatments that hopefully we'll have for our patients. And similar to tenapovir, boceprevir, when we had just that, it was like, okay, well, I guess we're stuck with this and this is what we have and this is what we can expect. But then pretty soon thereafter, really new medications that were much better were developed. So I really, really hope the same happens with hepatitis B, but I do appreciate that hepatitis B is much more, maybe more complex. But nonetheless, I think it's really exciting to have at least something that offers functional cure. And hopefully others will follow. And hopefully patients can, if they don't respond to this one, move on to the next.
And I don't think from an siRNA or ASO mechanism of action that resistance has really been part of the conversation. So I think when we talk about losing, you know, ground, it's if you make the virus more complicated than it started. And from what I understand, that doesn't seem to be part of this MOA. Is that correct?
That's my understanding too. Yeah.
You know, I just want to go back to the, you know, we're talking about all these risks about, you know, how the patients, the injection site reactions and all these other things. Whenever I look at a new drug, I look at discontinuation rates. It was about 3% in the clinical trial. Compare that back to the IDEAL trial with PEG, 14% of people discontinued that drug in a clinical trial. So, you know, putting it in perspective, I think that, you know, maybe I shouldn't be quite as worried as, you know, with a new drug as you know, we're kind of hinting at. But, you know, 3% discontinuation rate is not bad, you know, right, especially for a drug that, you know, you have an injection, elevated LFTs, et cetera. I think just putting that in perspective is important.
That's a really good point. Although I would say, you know, if I'm in clinical practice and I'm kind of seeing these patients and they come in with ALT over 3 times upper limit of normal in my clinical practice, I mean, my instinct is I'm really concerned. You know, I want this to go away. So whereas in a clinical trial, you just feel like maybe there's more support. And so I think the real world discontinuation may be higher, but I agree that 3% overall is really reassuring.
And I think that discontinuing the drug also doesn't end in like doom and gloom.
Right.
So you still have antiviral therapy, the oral. I mean, your patient's no worse off, I think, than if they had not tried the drug. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important context. And you look at GLP-1s, like a drug that we think that everyone in the world is now on, the discontinuation rate for those in clinical trials is much higher than 3%.
Right.
And yet our patients, and weekly injections, so any of our patients are very enthusiastic about trying those. So I think we won't know what our patients think until we really get it and can start using it in the real world. But
yeah,
just the fact that we have a new treatment, I think, is exciting.
Yeah,
very.
But do you really think that most of your patients would want to give it a try, or would it be more like 10%, 20%, 50%, 5%?
Yeah. I don't think it's, I don't anticipate it will be all the patients who would qualify biochemically that we will identify the appropriate patient and then many of those patients will choose against it, I'm sure. But one of the questions I, I just wanted to explore is many patients now with hepatitis B are not in our practices, right? They're in primary care practices, especially the Asian population, right? There are several primary care practitioners in the community that manage large groups of hepatitis B patients. Do you think that's an appropriate setting? Do you think those practitioners will be, because that's where a lot of these patients are sitting. They're not really in hepatology practices always. What are we thinking about the uptake from a physician side in those practices?
That's a really good point. And I think probably the first step will have to be to increase education and awareness that this treatment is on the horizon. And I do think that GSK, the company that makes Bepi, are really thinking actively about how to do that and how to target their educational efforts. So the first step, I think, will be to make everyone aware that it's on the horizon. But then in terms of where this treatment is administered, again, it will depend on how it looks in terms of monitoring. But to me, it seems more that there will be some specialized centers that are able to take this on and treat with this medication. So would it be a situation where those patients who are currently being followed in primary care actually have to be referred to a specialized center just to complete this treatment course and then referred back to their primary care for ongoing treatment after? I'm just not convinced that with all the nuances with this treatment that will be able to be done in routine primary care settings. But I think we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think that not all PCPs are the same, right?
No.
So a lot of our Asian patients are their Hep B is followed by a primary care provider that has a lot of expertise yes. in hepatitis B. And our primary care doctors do hard things, right? They can give GLP-1s, which are an injection therapy. They might be using, you know, cholesterol medicines that are alternative options. They might be giving bisphosphonates that are IV. I mean, there's lots of things that PCPs do that are inconvenient. I think a primary care that has a large population of Hep B might really be excited about another drug because it affects a majority of the patients. I think PCPs that have a handful of Hep B patients, that's where liver cancer surveillance and even, you know, antiviral therapy may not be done the way that our guidance would suggest. And those patients are probably going to have to be linked to a more specialized center. I also think that just the approval of a new drug and a new mechanism of action will have an uptick in screening, right? One of the biggest issues in the U.S. is the majority of Hep B patients are still not diagnosed. And of those that are diagnosed and appropriate for treatment, the majority are not on any treatment. So hopefully it'll shift a little more towards screening and standard of care.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that is a really good point. And I think that, yeah, it will depend on the care setting and, you know, whether if they do have many patients who have hepatitis B, then why not take this on? But again, the question of ALT flares, I mean, I'm scared when I see these high ALT elevations. How about a primary care doctor who is seeing all these hepatitis B carriers or, you know, patients that are relatively well controlled who hasn't really dealt with ALT flares in this setting? You know, so I think it's those kind of situations that may be a little bit distinct in a specialized setting versus primary care. But I agree that if they have a lot of hepatitis B experience, they may want to be able to be the ones that are offering this to their patients.
Yeah. Just a quick question, Tatiana. Do we know if those ALT flares are immune-based or direct drug toxicity? Because there would be a difference, right, in terms of how I respond to what action I might take.
Right. I mean, my understanding is that it's thought to be that they're largely immune-based as opposed to direct drug toxicity. But how do you know that for sure? I guess related to timing of when they occur, maybe. But again, you know, we've seen that many of these flares are associated with surface antigen loss. So that's a beneficial aspect. But you just don't know in the real world, right? If they're having significantly elevated ALT and it doesn't improve on its own, how long do you keep them on a medication that you're not 100% sure is not the cause of this?
Also, I think that it's important that the trial kept patients on nukes. And then if they met certain endpoints, then they would consider stopping the nukes. I think that when you're looking at complicated protocols or a patient that's enthusiastic about a cure, if they stop their background antiviral therapy, they might experience a flare that you now think is a favorable, you know, flare to that leads to clearance, and it's really just reactivation.
Yeah.
Right.
I still think this is exciting, and I don't think the majority of my patients are going to want to try it, but there will be some enthusiastic souls.
Yeah, no, I actually, again, with the discussions that I've had so far, as soon as I mentioned that there's a new treatment on the horizon after, you know, 5 years, 10 years going to see their doctor, and every time asking about, is there anything new? Will I stay on nukes forever? For the first time to say this, there's a lot of enthusiasm. Now, will that enthusiasm translate to them actually going on this medication? I think we'll have to see. But I think it may be something similar to what we saw with resmetirom, you know, resmetirom, like the first drug in for the treatment of this condition. I think it really surpassed our expectations in terms of uptake. And being the first in treatment option in that class, I think that goes a long way. And so similarly, I do think that there will be a similar effect, especially in the beginning when people say, okay, this is the newest thing. This is the first medication that can offer functional cure. Let's give it a try. But then we'll have to see what the monitoring looks like.
I think this is a big shift, right, in our ability to care for these patients with hepatitis B. It is really exciting. It's not the be-all, end-all answer. Most therapies are not, but this is a great start, and I think a really exciting time for our patients with hepatitis B.
I agree.
So I would say, for a handful of takeaways, my first takeaway is that we really should be checking quantitative Hep B surface antigen. That's going to start to identify those patients that might be appropriate for this new drug and probably some of the therapies that are going to be released going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And even just learning about your own practice and the patients you have and the ranges of quantitative surface antigen. And, you know, even if they don't go on the treatment, that can inform some of your counseling. But hopefully many patients will potentially qualify. That's the first step. And then we'll see about when it becomes approved, if they'll go on to take on the medication.
That's great.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tatiana. Thank you, everyone, for joining Kim and Nancy for the Liver Lineup updates and unfiltered insights. And please feel free to you know, log on to any of our other prior podcasts. They're usually a lot of fun. So, and hopefully a great learning environment. Thank you.